friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now, and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a minute to thank you, the listener. Everyone who has been listening to the show since it started back in 2019, whether it's from day one or close to day one, or even if you're new to joining us. Thank you to the people who have listened, shared, and supported the show in many wonderful and kind ways. This podcast is still around thanks to you. This week, I'd like to ask for a bit of a different kind of favor, if you're so inclined, of course. If you listen on Spotify, and that's where the majority of my listenership is, you can now rate podcasts. I don't know if this will help me reach new audiences, but it seems simple and worth a try. So if you are listening to the show and you've got to listen to a couple of episodes before you can do it, so please give it a go, and let's see what happens. And if you'd like to support Sleepy Tom Tales, to help me keep it ad-free and going out to thousands of insomniacs just like you, please consider supporting it on Patreon. That's patreon.com/sleepytimetales. This is a monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can get you fun bonuses based on how much you contribute. I've updated some of the monthly bonuses. The mini-sode short stories have now become poetry readings. For January, we're doing Emily Dickinson, and I've really rather enjoyed it. This is available to patrons at the $5 level, and I think it's definitely something worth checking out. So if you're curious, take a peek. Once again, that's patreon.com/sleepytimetales or patron.sleepytimetales.net, and have a look at what's there. And you know something? I'm going to leave it there tonight. I'm going to shout out the music, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Their music is available on their website at royaltyfreakmusic.com. Thank you for the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Tom Tales? What is it for? It's a strange idea, after all. A podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to. But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Tom Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night. Or maybe sometimes background noise, or even just company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without putting you under any pressure with the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The main idea behind it is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. But maybe you need something a little bit different. Maybe one of those people that likes a little bit of background noise, some kind of white noise, or the sound of the wind in the trees, or the rain, or the ocean, or maybe just some boring dude droning on in the background. But what is very important is that you don't try force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, if all goes well, I'm hoping you're asleep before we get to the end of the episode. but it's important you don't feel pressurized. This will probably not work on your first night. I recommend giving it a solid 3 nights try to see if you can get used to the strangeness of the idea, to get used to my voice, my maybe slightly strange accent, or maybe at least at first, especially at first, one episode just isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe you're one of those who wakes up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because of what works for me, is to let the podcast run all night. Download a whole bunch of episodes, enough to go for a solid 8 to 10 hours. Playlist them and start with the latest and let them go. That way, if you find yourself waking up at 3 a.m. and you are staring at the ceiling, you can just pop your earbuds back in and allow yourself to go straight back to sleep again. You can even do the same sort of thing if you wake up 60 minutes or even 30 minutes before your alarm. May sound strange, may seem pointless, what's an extra 30 minutes of sleep? But if you do that sort of thing, wake up, pop your earbuds back in, or carry on listening, however you're listening, and go back to sleep again, there's something about that that is just can be the most restful night, part of the night. There's something about allowing yourself to relax completely right before the alarm that's just satisfying on a whole new, deep, deep level. So now you need to try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this will probably seem strange to you. So I ask that you give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. The Elements of Geology by William Harmon Norton, Professor of Geology in Cornell College. Preface. Geology is a science of such rapid growth that no apology is expected when from time to time a new textbook is added to those already in the field. The present work, however, is the outcome of the need of a textbook of a very simple outline, in which causes and their consequences should be knit together as closely as possible. A need long felt by the author and his teaching, and perhaps by other teachers also. The author has ventured, therefore, to depart from the common usage which subdivides geology into a number of departments: dynamical, structural, physiographic, and historical, and to treat an immediate connection with each geological process, the landforms, and the rock structures which it has produced. It is hoped that the facts of geology and the inferences drawn from them have been so presented as to afford an efficient discipline and inductive reasoning. Typical examples have been used to introduce many topics, and it has been the author's aim to give due proportion to both the wide generalizations of our science and to the concrete facts on which they rest. There have been added a number of practical exercises, such as the author has used for several years in the classroom. These are not made so numerous as to displace the problems which no doubt many teachers prefer to have their pupils solve impromptu during the recitation, but may, it is hoped, suggest their use. In historical geology, a broad view is given of the development of the North American continent and the evolution of life upon the planet. Only the leading types of plants and animals are mentioned, and special attention is given to those which mark the lines of descent of forms now living. By omitting much technical detail of a mineralogical and paleontological nature, and by confining the field of view almost wholly to our own continent, space has been obtained to give to what are deemed for beginners the essentials of the science a fuller treatment than perhaps is common. It is assumed that field work will be introduced with the commencement of the study. The common rocks are therefore briefly described in the open chapters. The drift also receives early mention, and teachers in the northern states who begin geology in the fall may prefer to take up the chapter on the Pleistocene immediately after the chapter on glaciers. Simple diagrams have been used freely, not only because they are often clearer than any verbal statement, but also because they readily lend themselves to reproduction on the blackboard by the pupil. The text will suggest others which the pupil may invent. It is hoped that the photographic views may also be used for exercises in the classroom. The generous aid of many friends is recognized with special pleasure. To Professor W.M. Davis of Harvard University, there is owing a large obligation for the broad conceptions and luminous statements of geologic facts and principles, with which he has enriched the literature of our science, and for his stimulating influence in education. It is hoped that both in subject matter and in method, the book itself makes evident this debt. But besides a general obligation shared by geologists everywhere, and in varying degrees by perhaps all authors of recent American textbooks in earth science, there is owing a debt direct and personal. The plan of the book, with its use of problems and treatments of landforms and rock structures in immediate connection with the processes which produce them, was submitted to Professor Davis, and receiving his approval, was carried into effect, although without the sanction of precedent at the time. Professor Davis also kindly consented to read the manuscript throughout, and his many helpful criticisms and suggestions are acknowledged with sincere gratitude. Parts of the manuscript have been reviewed by Dr. Samuel Kelvin and Dr. Frank M. Wilder of the State University of Iowa, Dr. S.W. Bayer of the Iowa College of Agriculture and Mechanical Arts, Dr. U.S. Grant of Northwestern University, Professor J.A. Udden of Augustana College, Illinois, Dr. C.H. Gordon of the New Mexico State School of Mines, Principal Maurice Ricker of the High School Burlington, Iowa, and the following former students of the author who are engaged in the earth sciences: Dr. W.C. Alden of the United States Geological Survey and the University of Chicago, Mr. Joseph Sniffen, instructor in the Academy of University of Chicago, Morgan Park, Professor Martin Yawns, Fort Worth University, Texas, Professor A.M. Jane, Dakota University, Professor G.H. Brentnell, Monmouth College, Illinois, Professor Howard E. Simpson, Colby College, Maine, Mr. E.J. Cable, instructor in the Iowa State Normal College, Principal C.C. Gray of the High School Fargo, North Dakota, and Mr. Charles Persons of the High School Hannibal, Missouri. A large number of the diagrams of the book were drawn by Mr. W.W. White of the Art School of Cornell College. To all these friends and to the many who have kindly supplied the illustrations of the text, whose names are mentioned in an appended list, the writer returns his heartfelt thanks. William Harmon Norton, Cornell College, Mount Vernon, Iowa, July 1905. Introductory note. During the preparation of this book, Professor Norton has frequently discussed its plan with me by correspondence, and we have considered together the matters of scope, arrangement, and presentation. As to scope, the needs of the young student and not of the expert have been our guide. The book is therefore a textbook, not a reference volume. In arrangement, the twofold division of the subject was chosen because of its simplicity and effectiveness. The principles of physical geology come first. The several chapters are arranged in what is believed to be a natural order, appropriate to the greatest part of our country, so that from a simple beginning, a logical sequence of topics leads through the whole subject. the historical view of the science comes second, with many specific illustrations of the physical processes previously studied, but now set forth as part of the story of the Earth, with its many changes of aspect and its succession of inhabitants. Special attention is here given to North America, and care is taken to avoid overloading with details. With respect to method of presentation, it must not be forgotten that the textbook is only one factor in good teaching, and that in geology, as in other sciences, the teacher, the laboratory, and the local field are other factors, each of which should play an appropriate part. The text suggests observational methods, but it cannot replace observation in field or laboratory. It offers certain exercises, but space cannot be taken to make it a laboratory manual, as well as a book for study. It explains many problems, but its statements are necessarily more terse than the illustrative descriptions that a good and experienced teacher should supply. Frequent use is made of induction and inference in order that the student may come to see how reasonable a science is geology, and that he may avoid the too common error of thinking that the opinions of authorities are reached by a private road that is closed to him. The further extension of this method of presentation is argued upon the teacher, so that the young geologist may always learn the evidence that leads to a conclusion, and not only the conclusion itself. W. M. Davis, Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts, July 1905. Contents, Introduction, The Scope and Aim of Geology. Part 1. External Geological Agencies. The Work of the Weather. The work of groundwater, rivers and valleys, river deposits, the work of glaciers, the work of the wind, the sea and its shores, offshore and deep sea deposits. Part 2. Internal Geological Agencies. Movements of the Earth crust, earthquakes, volcanoes, underground structures of igneous origin, metamorphism and mineral veins. Part 3. Historical Geology. The Geological Record. The Precambrian Systems. The Cambrian. The Ordovician and Silurian. The Devonian. The Carboniferous. The Mesozoic. The Tertiary. The Quaternary. Index. Elements of Geology. Introduction. The Scope and Aim of Geology. Geology deals with the rocks of the Earth's crust. It learns from their composition and structure how the rocks were made and how they have been modified. It ascertains how they have been brought to their present places and wrought to their various topographic forms, such as hills and valleys, plains and mountains. It studies the vestiges which the rocks preserve of ancient organisms which once inhabited our planet. Geology is the history of the Earth and its inhabitants, as read in the rocks of the Earth's crust. To obtain a general idea of the nature and method of our science, before beginning its study in detail, we may visit some valley such as that illustrated on the frontispiece, on whose sides are rocky ledges. Here the rocks lie in horizontal layers. Although only their edges are exposed, we may infer that these layers run into the upland on either side, and underlie the entire district. They are part of the foundation of solid rock which everywhere is found beneath the loose materials of the surface. The ledges of the valley of our illustration are of sandstone. Looking closely at the rock, we see it is composed of myriads of grains of sand cemented together. These grains have been worn and rounded. They are sorted also, those of each layer being about of a size. By some means they have been brought hither from some more ancient source. Surely these grains have had a history before they here found a resting place. A history which we are to learn to read. The successive layers of rock suggest they were built one upon another from the bottom upward. We may be as sure that each layer was formed before those above it, as that bottom course of stone in a wall were laid before the courses which rest upon them. Indeed, we have no reason to believe that the lowest layers which we see here were the earliest ever formed. Indeed, some deep boring in the vicinity may prove that their ledges rest upon other layers of rock, which extend downward for many hundreds of feet below the valley floor. Nor may we conclude that the highest layers here were the latest ever laid. For elsewhere we may find still later layers lying upon them. A short search may find in the rock relics of animals, such as the imprints of shells, which lived when it was deposited. And as these are of kinds whose nearest living relatives now have their home in the sea, we infer that it was on the flat sea floor that the sandstone was laid. Its present position, hundreds of feet above sea level, proves that it has since emerged to form part of the land, while the flatness of the beds shows that the movement was so uniform and gentle as not to break or strongly bend them from their original attitude. The surface of some of these layers is ripple marked. Hence the sand must once have been as loose as that of a shallow sea bottom, and sea beaches today, which is thrown into similar ripples by movements of the water. In some way, the grains have since become cemented into firm rock. Note that the layers on one side of the valley agree with those on the other, each matching the one opposite at the same level. Once they were continuous across the valley. Where the valley now is was once a continuous upland built of horizontal layers. The layers now show the edges or outcrop on the valley sides, because they have been cut by the valley trench. The rock of the ledges is crumbling away. At the foot of each step of rock lie fragments which have fallen. Thus the valley is slowly widening. It has been narrow in the past, it will be wider in the future. Through the valley runs a stream. The waters of rains which have fallen on the upper parts of the stream's basin are now on their way to the river and the sea. Rock fragments and grains of sand creeping down the valley slopes come within reach of the stream and are washed along by the running water. Here and there they lodge for a time in banks of sand and gravel, but sooner or later they are taken up again and carried on. The grains of sand which were brought from some ancient source to form these rocks are on their way to some new goal. As they are washed along the rocky bed of the stream, they'll slowly rasp and wear it deeper. The valley will be deeper in the future. It has been less deep in the past. In this little valley we see slow changes now in progress. We find also in the composition of the structure and the altitude of the rocks, and the landforms to which they have been sculpted, the record of a long succession of past changes, involving the origin of sand grains and their gathering, and deposit upon the bottom of some ancient sea. The cementation of the layers into solid rock, the uplift of the rocks to form a land surface, and last of all, the carving of a valley in the upland. Everywhere, in the fields, along the river, among the mountains, by the seashore, and in the desert, we may discover slow changes now in progress, and the record of similar changes in the past. Everywhere we may catch glimpses of a process of gradual change which stretches backwards into the past and forward into the future, by which the forms and structures of the face of the earth are continually built and continually destroyed. The science which deals with this long process is geology. G geology treats of the natural changes now taking place upon the earth and within it, the agencies which produce them, and the landforms and rock structures which result. It studies the changes of the present in order to be able to read the history of the earth's changes in the past. The various agencies which have fashioned the face of the earth may be divided into two general classes. In part one, we shall consider those which work upon the earth from without, such as the weather, running water, glaciers, the wind, and the sea. In part two, we shall treat of those agencies whose sources are within the earth, and among whose manifestations are volcanoes and earthquakes, and the various movements of the earth's crust. As we study each agency, we shall notice not only how does it work, but also the records which it leaves in the rock structures and the landforms which it produces. With this preparation, we shall be able, in part three, to read in the records of the rocks the history of our planet and the successive forms of life which have dwelt upon it. Part 1. External Geological Agencies. Chapter 1. The Work of the Weather. In our excursion to the valley with sandstone ledges, we witnessed a process which is going forward in all lands. Everywhere the rocks are crumbling away, their fragments are creeping down hillsides to the stream, and are carried by the streams to the sea where they are rebuilt into rocky layers. When again the rocks are lifted to form land, the process will begin anew. Again they will crumble and creep down slopes and be washed by streams to the sea. Let us begin our study of this long cycle of change at the point where rocks disintegrate and decay under the action of the weather. In studying now a few outcrops and quarries, we shall learn a little of some common rocks and how they weather away. Stratification and joining. At the sandstone ledges, we saw that the rock was divided into parallel layers. The thicker layers are known as strata, and thin leaves into which each stratum may sometimes be split are termed laminae. To a greater or less degree, these layers differ from each other in fineness of grain, showing that the material has been sorted. The planes which divide them are called bedding planes. Besides the bedding planes, there are other division planes, which cut across the strata from top to bottom. These are found in all rocks and are known as joints. Two sets of joints, running at about right angles to each other, together with the bedding planes, divide the sandstone into quadrangular blocks. Sandstone. Examining a piece of sandstone, we find it composed of grains, quite like those of river sand or of sea beaches. Most of the grains are a clear, glassy mineral called quartz. These quartz grains are very hard and will scratch the steel of a knife blade. They are not affected by acid, and their broken surfaces are irregular, like those of broken glass. The grains of sandstone are held together by some cement. This may be calcareous, consisting of soluble carbonate of lime. In brown sandstones, the cement is frequently ferruginous, hydrated iron oxide or iron rust, forming the bond. Somewhat as is the case of iron nails which have rusted together. The strongest and most lasting cement is siliceous, and sand rocks whose grains are closely cemented by silica, the chemical substance of which quartz is made, are known as quartzites. We are now prepared to understand how sandstone is affected by the action of the weather. On ledges, where the rock is exposed to view, its surface is more or less discolored, and the grains are loose and may be rubbed off with the finger. On gentle slopes, the rock is covered with a soil composed of sand, which evidently is crumbled sandstone, and dark carbonaceous matter derived from the decay of vegetation. Clearly, it is by the dissolving of the cement that the rock thus breaks down to loose sand, a piece of sandstone with calcareous cement or a bit of old mortar, which is really an artificial stone, also made of sand cemented by lime, may be treated in a test tube with hydrochloric acid to illustrate the process. A limestone quarry. Here also we find the rock stratified and jointed. On the quarry face, the rock is distinctly seen to be altered for some distance from its upper surface. Below the altered zone, the rock is sound and is quarried for building, but the altered upper layers are too soft and broken to be used for this purpose. If the limestone is laminated, the laminae here have split apart, although below, they hold fast together. Near the surface, the stone has become rotten and crumbles at the touch, while on the top it is completely broken down to a thin layer of limestone meal, on which rests a fine reddish clay. Limestone is made of minute grains of carbonate of lime, all firmly held together by a calcareous cement. A piece of the stone placed in a test tube with hydrochloric acid dissolves with brisk effervescence, leaving insoluble impurities, which are disseminated through it, at the bottom of the tube, as little clay. We can now understand the changes in the upper layers of the quarry. At the surface of the rock, the limestone is completely dissolved, leaving the insoluble residue as a layer of reddish clay. Immediately below the clay, the rock has disintegrated into meal, where the cement between the limestone grains has been removed. While beneath this, laminae are split apart, where the cement has been dissolved only along the planes of lamination, where the stone is more porous. As these changes in the rock are greatest at the surface and diminish downward, we infer that they have been caused by agents working downwards from the surface. At certain points, these agencies have been more effective than elsewhere. The upper rock surface is pitted. Joints are widened as they approach the surface, and along these seams we may find that the rock is altered, even down to the quarry floor. A shale pit. Let us now visit some pit where shale, a laminated and somewhat hardened clay, is quarried for the manufacture of brick. The laminae of this fine-grained rock may be as thin as cardboard in places, and close joints may break the rock into small rhombic blocks. On the upper structure, we note that the shale has weathered to a clayey soil, in which all traces of structure have been destroyed. The clay and the upper layers of the shale beneath it are reddish or yellow, while in many cases the color of the unaltered rock beneath is blue. Sedimentary rocks. The three kinds of layered rocks whose acquaintance we have made, sandstone, limestone, and shale, are the leading types of the great group of stratified or sedimentary rocks. This group includes all rocks made of sediments, the materials having settled either in water or upon the bottoms of rivers, lakes or seas, or on dry land, as in the case of deposits made by the wind and by glaciers. Sedimentary rocks are divided into the fragmental rocks, which are made of fragments, either coarse or fine, and the far less common rocks, which are constituted of chemical precipitates. The sedimentary rocks are divided according to their composition into the following classes. The arsenious or quartz rocks, including beds of loose sand and gravel, sandstone, quartzite, and conglomerate. A rock made of cemented, rounded gravel or pebbles. The calcareous or lime rock, including limestone and a soft white rock formed of calcareous powder known as chalk. The argillaceous or clay rocks, including muds, clays, and shales. These three classes pass by mixture into one another. Thus there are limny and clayey sandstones, sandy and clayey limestones, and sandy and limey shales. Granite. This familiar rock may be studied as an example of the second great group of rocks, the unstratified or igneous rocks. These are not made of cemented sedimentary grains, but of interlocking crystals which have crystallized from a molten mass. Examining a piece of granite, the most conspicuous crystals which meet the eye are those of feldspar. They are commonly pink, white or yellow and break along smooth cleavage planes, which reflect the light like tiny panes of glass. Mica may be recognized by its glittering plates, which split into thin elastic scales. A third mineral, harder than steel, breaking along irregular surfaces like broken glass, we identify as quartz. How granite alters under the action of the weather may be seen in outcrops where it forms bedrock, or country rock, underlying the loose formations of the surface, and in many parts of the northern states where granite boulders and pebbles more or less decayed may be found in a surface sheet of stony clay called the drift. Of the different minerals composing granite, quartz alone remains unaltered. Mica weathers to detached flakes which have lost their elasticity. The feldspar crystals have lost their luster and hardness, and even have decayed to clay. Where long weathered granite forms the country rock, it often may be cut with spade or trowel for several feet from the surface, so rotten is the feldspar. And here the rock is seen to break down to a clayey soil containing grains of quartz and flakes of mica. There are a few simple illustrations of the surface changes which some of the common kinds of rocks undergo. The agencies by which these changes are brought about will now take up under two divisions: chemical agencies, producing rock decay, and mechanical agencies, producing rock disintegration. The chemical work of water. As water falls on the earth in rain, it has already absorbed from the air carbon dioxide, carbonic acid gas, and oxygen. As it sinks into the ground and becomes what is termed groundwater, it takes into solution from the soil humus acids and carbon dioxide, both of which are constantly being generated there by the decay of organic matter. So both rain and groundwater are charged with active chemical agents, by the help of which they corrode and rust and decompose all rocks to a greater or less degree. We notice now three of the chief chemical processes concerned in weathering: solution, the formation of carbonates, and oxidation. Solution. Limestone, although so little affected by pure water that 5,000 gallons would be needed to dissolve a single pound, is easily dissolved in water charged with carbon dioxide. In limestone regions, well water is therefore hard. On boiling the water for some time, the carbon dioxide gas is expelled. The whole of the lime carbonate can no longer be held in solution, and much of it is thrown down to form a crust, or scale, in the kettle or in the tubes of the steam boiler. All waters which flow over limestone rocks or soak through them are constantly engaged in dissolving them away, and in the course of time destroy beds of vast extent and great thickness. The upper surface of limestone rocks becomes deeply pitted, as we saw in the limestone quarry, and where the mantle of waste has been removed, it may be found so intricately furrowed that it is difficult to traverse. Beds of rock salt buried among the strata are dissolved by seeping water, which issues in salt springs. Gypsum, a mineral composed of hydrated sulfate of lime, and so soft that it may be scratched with a fingernail, is readily taken up by water, giving to the water of wells and springs a peculiar hardness difficult to remove. The dissolving action of moisture may be noted on marble tombstones of some age, marble being a limestone altered by heat and pressure, and composed of crystalline grains. by assuming that the date on each monument marks the year of its erection. One may estimate how many years on average it has taken for weathering to loosen fine grains on the polished surface, so that they may be rubbed off with the finger, to destroy the polish, to round the sharp edges of tool marks and the lettering, and at last to open cracks and seams and break down the stone. We may notice also whether the gravestones weather more rapidly on the sunny or the shady side, and on the sides or on top. The weathered surface of granular limestone containing shells shows them standing in relief. As the shells are made of crystalline carbonate of lime, we may infer whether the carbonate of lime is less soluble in its granular or its crystalline condition. The formation of carbonates. In attacking minerals, water does more than merely take them into solution. It decomposes them, forming new chemical compounds of which the carbonates are among the most important. Thus, feldspar consists of the insoluble silicate of alumina, together with certain alkaline silicates which are broken up by the action of water containing carbon dioxide, forming alkaline carbonates. These carbonates are freely soluble and contribute potash and soda to soils and river waters. By the removal of the soluble ingredients of feldspar, there is left the silicate of alumina, united with water, or hydrated, in the condition of a fine plastic clay, which when white and pure is known as kaolin, and is used in the manufacture of porcelain. Feldspathic rocks which contain no iron compounds thus weather to whitish crusts, and even apparently sound crystals of feldspar, when ground to thin slices and placed under the microscope, may be seen to be milky in color throughout, because an internal change to kaolin has begun. Oxidation. Rocks containing compounds of iron weather to reddish crusts, and the seams of these rocks are often lined with rusty films. Oxygen and water have here united with the iron, forming hydrated iron oxide. The effects of oxidation may be seen in the alteration of many kinds of rocks, and in red and yellow colors of soils and subsoils. Pyrite is a very hard mineral, of a pale brass color, found in scattered crystals in many rocks, and is composed of iron and sulfur, iron sulfide. Under the attack of the weather, it takes up oxygen, forming iron sulfate, green vitriol, a soluble compound, an insoluble hydrated iron oxide, which is a mineral known as limonite. Several large masses of iron sulfide were placed some years ago on the lawn in front of the National Museum at Washington. The mineral changed so rapidly to green vitriol that enough of this poisonous compound was washed into the ground to kill the roots of the surrounding grass. Agents of mechanical disintegration. Heat and cold. Rocks exposed to the direct rays of the sun become strongly heated by day and expand. After sunset, they rapidly cool and contract. When the difference in temperature between night and day is considerable, the repeated strains of sudden expansion and contraction at last become greater than the rocks can bear, and they break, for the same reason that a glass cracks when plunged into boiling water. Rocks are poor conductors of heat, and hence their surfaces may become painfully hot under the full blaze of the sun, while the interior remains comparatively cool. By day, the surface shell expands and tends to break loose from the mass of the stone. In cooling in the evening, the surface shell suddenly contracts on the unyielding interior, and in time is forced off in scales. Many rocks, such as granite, are made up of grains of various minerals which differ in color and in their capacities to absorb heat, and which therefore contract and expand in different ratios. In heating and cooling, these grains crowd against their neighbors and tear loose from them, so that finally the rock disintegrates into sand. The conditions for the destructive action of heat and cold are most fully met in arid regions, when vegetation is wanting for lack of sufficient rain. The soil not being held together by the roots of plants is blown away over large areas, leaving the rocks bare to the blazing sun in a cloudless sky. The air is dry, and the heat received by the earth by day is therefore rapidly radiated at night into space. There is a sharp and sudden fall of temperature after sunset, and the rocks, strongly heated by day, are now chilled perhaps even to the freezing point. In the Sahara, the thermometer has been known to fall 131 degrees Fahrenheit within a few hours. In the light air of the Pamir Plateau in Central Asia, a rise of 90 degrees Fahrenheit has been recorded, from 7 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. On the mountains of southwestern Texas, there are frequently heard cracking noises as the rocks of that arid region throw scales from a fraction of an inch to 4 inches in thickness, and loud reports are made as huge boulders split apart. Desert pebbles weakened by long exposure to heat and cold have been shivered to fine, sharp-pointed fragments on being placed in sand heated to 180 degrees Fahrenheit. Beds half a foot thick, forming the floor of limestone quarries in Wisconsin, have been known to buckle and arch and break to fragments under the heat of the summer sun. Frost. By this term is meant the freezing and thawing of water contained in the pores and crevices of rocks. All rocks are more or less porous, and all contain more or less water in their pores. Workers in stone call this quarry water, and speak of a stone as green before the quarry water has dried out. Water also seeps along joints and bedding planes and gathers in all seams and crevices. Water expands in freezing 10 cubic inches of water freezing to about 11 cubic inches of ice. As water freezes in the rifts and pores of rocks, it expands with irresistible force, illustrated in the freezing and breaking of water pipes in winter. The first rift in the rock, perhaps too narrow to be seen, is widened, little by little, by the wedges of successive frosts. And finally, the rock is broken into detached blocks, and these into angular chipped stone by the same process. It is on mountaintops and in high latitudes that the effects of frost are most plainly seen. "Every summit," says Whymper, "amongst the rock summits upon which I have stood, has been nothing but a piled-up heap of fragments." In Iceland, in Spitsbergen, in Kamchatka, and in other frigid lands, areas are thickly strewn with sharp-edged fragments into which the rock has been shattered by frost. Organic agents. We must reckon the roots of plants and trees among the agents which break rocks into pieces. The tiny rootlet, in its search for food and moisture, inserts itself into some minute rift, and as it grows slowly wedges the rock apart. Moreover, the acids of the root corrode the rocks with which they are in contact. One may sometimes find in the soil a block of limestone wrapped in a mesh of roots, each of which lies in a little furrow where it is eaten into the stone. Rootless plants called lichens often cover and corrode rocks, as yet bare of soil. But where lichens are destroying the rock less rapidly than does the weather, they serve in a way as protection. Conditions favoring disintegration and decay. The disintegration of rocks under frost and temperature changes goes on most rapidly in cold and arid climates, and where vegetation is scant or absent. On the contrary, the decay of rocks under the chemical action of water is favored by a warm, moist climate and abundant vegetation. Frost and heat and cold can only act within the few feet from the surface to which the necessary temperature changes are limited, while water penetrates and alters the rocks to great depths. The pupil may explain. In what ways the presence of joints and bedding planes assists in the breaking up and decay of rocks under the action of the weather. Why it is a good rule of stonemasons never to lay stones on edge, but always on their natural bedding planes. While stones fresh from the quarry sometimes go to pieces in early winter, when stones which have been quarried for some months remain uninjured. While quarrymen in the northern states often keep their quarry floors flooded during winter. While laminated limestone should not be used for curbstone. While rocks composed of layers differing in fineness of grain and in ratios of expansion do not make good building stone. Fine-grained rocks with pores so small that capillary attraction keeps the water which they contain from readily draining away are more apt to hold their pores 10/11 full of water than are rocks whose pores are larger, which therefore are more likely to be injured by frost, which is subject to greater temperature changes, a dark rock or one of a light color, the north side or the south side of a valley. And I think I'm going to leave it there with that little pop quiz. If you would like to pick up where we're leaving off, learning about the elements of geology, you can, as always, find the original on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes were released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Nights and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.